You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Shane, are really wonderful ways of helping you in lots of different situations, and they're also creating beauty. So this is not merely for all the knitters and the crocheters. This is for everyone here who, you know, that moment of creativity in your mind, that moment where something comes out, and it does. This is one of the things that I say when I do poetry later on as well, which is the fact that never worry about, because a lot of us, we have the critic in our head. I couldn't start writing poetry until, fortunately, an autistic stranger said to me, "Can I talk to you about your mind?" And I found out about how my mind was working and why I used to have all that anxiety and self-loathing. And once I lost that critical voice that had been so loud for most of my life, I suddenly could just write poetry. And I want to say to all of you, everyone here, who sometimes you sit down to create something and then you hear the voice of a teacher that you've made in your head, or maybe a teacher of your past, who says, "That's not proper poetry. That's not a proper painting." If you call it a painting, if you call it a poetry, if you call it an essay, if you call it a sculpture, whatever it might be, it is that. And it doesn't matter. So just create, 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 because it is a beautiful act of rebellion. So this is called Never. Thank you. Never bully the woolly maker. Her worry is concealed in a knitting pattern, the anxiety expelled through the clicketing of needles. The comic sneers, sips his beer, thinks he'll win the floor by asking, "What you knitting for?" But I wish he knew a little more of how the wool can unspool the tightness of the fear of being here. He's knitting for his mind, she's knitting for her niece, fresh born and in need of a rainbow-coloured fleece. From this anxiety and one shaved sheep, they have found a way that they can peep a little further into the world and also make it warmer. And later on, waiting for the night bus, we see the comic shivering, wishing his top was a little more robust. He can't see us, happy in the shelter, toasty and roasty and all wrapped up. We aren't bullies, we praise those who make our woolies. Straight to the crochet. Straight to the crochet to avoid the fight. I was doing the Latitude Festival last year, and there was a 12-year-old backstage and she was crocheting, and I just asked her about why she loved crochet. In the middle of the room, she sits, secure, consumed, oblivious to us all, so focused on her yarn, fingers fast, but also calm. I ask her of the crochet and the joy that it brings. I wonder what she'll say. And then, with hands still invested in creation, she tells me, "In my solitude, I can never be alone. Between my hands, I always hold an impending friend." And I thought, the beauty of that, I always hold an impending friend. And I saw her dad, Chris, a little bit later on. And I told Chris what his daughter had said. And he said, "She never talks to me like that." So, I've got a little extra thing today, because it's not just me. I have a friend of mine who is, amongst other things, for 15 years has been in the band King Crimson. And he is one of the most amazing artists and musicians that I know. And he's going to join me for a few poems. So please welcome to the stage, Jack Ojakchik.
Very good.
He's called Jack Ojakchik now. He didn't used to be. He used to be Jacko, but he's now Jack Ojakchik because he's got his Irish passport.
Yes!
And I'll tell you what, he's been looking down his nose at me. So I'm going to do a little poem. This is a poem that I wrote called The Quiet One, because when I was writing Normally Weird and Weirdly Normal, I met so many people, and of course since I've met so many more people who have battled with neurodivergence, who have not believed, didn't know they were neurodivergent, because in particular women have been left out of this story, as they are so often left out of this story. And I would meet, you know, women who had never known that they'd lived most of their life, they were autistic, but they hadn't known, and so they had believed that they had failed as human beings, when actually they were just different human beings. And you know what I will always say, and I've obviously I'm not even going to mention that stupid documentary on Channel 4 that was so ignorant and hateful and vile. Why would anyone want to increase the sum total of unhappiness in the world when we can increase the sum total of happiness? You know, when I meet, like, I remember there's a book called The Age of Diagnosis, which I'm not overly keen on. And at one point in that book, it says, anecdotally, I worry that the majority of people diagnosed with ADHD see no palpable improvement in their life. And then continues by saying, though many of them say they're happier. Now, is that a palpable improvement? Is it? I don't know. And that's what I want. I genuinely think the problem is how we've built society. The problem is that the corridors of normality are too tight. The problem is, you know, one of the things that happens with neurodivergence, by the way, is it very often leads to an increase in Marxism. And it is... Our society is not fit for purpose for so many different people, right? And so there was a woman who came up to me when Age of Diagnosis came out, and she was in tears. She was 48 years old. She'd always known, really, but she hadn't had the permission. And then she now had the permission, and she'd found out she was autistic, and she was in tears because that book got so much publicity and so many of those sneering people that she started to feel like an imposter again. So I want to say to all of you, everyone here who's in that battle, please know that what the media are and what so many politicians are is not what I believe the majority of human beings are. I see a world that is filled with progress and hope and love, and so many people with platforms trying to silence it. And what I love about festivals like this is I know the sense of community and connection that happens here, and it will revitalise us for the rest of the year. And it will mean that sometimes we might feel alone in the town that we live in or the village that we live in, but in this field we've met people and we go, right, my heart is growing again and my heart feels stronger. So this one is called The Quiet One, and it's for all of those people who, you know, so often ADHD is not jumping up and down, it's being filled with anxiety so you're still, so everyone thinks you're the best behaved child without knowing that in your head there is a terrible chaos. So do you want to start on this one, Jacko? Fingers relentlessly unpicking the anxious alopecia of another woolly jumper. Under the desk, skin picked to the quick, stomach sick, dread accelerates, thumbnail digs. Wishing for a note to be an absentee from another bout of failures and insults in PE. Pierced by every slight. Seeks possibility of escape. The safest place, the library in the lunch break. Seeks solace in a comic book. Is this forever? This shitty, shitty world that drowns you. But one day, I promise, you will see from all of this unnecessary agony has come forth someone so much more intriguing, complex, resplendent. Make it through. We're waiting for you. You will be fated. We will be magnificent. Thank you, Jacko. Thank you very much. Now, some of you might know that I used to do a show called The Infinite Monkey Cage, which I resigned from. I loved making that show so much. And I resigned from it last year. And I resigned because in my private life, on my own personal account, they had had issues for years over some of the things that I spoke about. One of the major things was that I was kind of gaslit by the anti-trans movement for about 5 years. And I reached a point of having to just decide that they kept saying, you're not allowed to say this, can you not say that, it creates trouble. People used to write to the BBC and say that I shouldn't be allowed to present the science show because I knew nothing about about the science of gender. I was told not to talk about historical cases of abuse in institutions. And all of these things, I have friends like my friend Lucia Osborne Crowley. If you don't know her, she's amazing. She wrote a book called The Lasting Harm about the Ghislaine Maxwell trial. And she's one of the reasons that I resigned, because I see the power in her and what she fights for, and fights for all of those people, those survivors from Epstein. And I thought of the poet Audre Lorde, "Your silence will not protect you." And I thought of Andrea Gibson, who said, "The truth may not be hopeful, but the telling of it is." And so I think it's very, you know, as someone who's old enough to remember Section 28, as I watch all these different things, the increase in ableism that we're seeing, the increase in transphobia and homophobia and misogyny and so many different things. And when I was down in Plymouth and I was just leaving Plymouth, actually. I'd just been to their local LGBT bookshop, by the way, which I've realised, by the way, I said that the other day, LGBT shop, I thought, isn't that the perfect kind of tea shop? An LGBT shop? And all of the different scones will be based around different kind of icons, you know. But yeah, and their LGBT bookshop is actually called, it's called The Old Queeriosity Shop, which I think is a fantastic title. And it was also Trans Pride that day. And I was walking up to the station and I saw a man walking his dogs with a Proud Dad t-shirt on. And when I got to platform 3, I thought, I'm going to write a poem for this man. Because I just saw him and I just went, nice t-shirt. And then I put it up on Instagram and I got lots of like nice little comments and little moments. And then I saw one comment and it had a picture with it. And I thought, I recognise that man. It's Nick. Nick was Proud Dad, and he'd found... So this is for Nick, and this is for all the proud parents. He's walking the dogs with his Proud Dad t-shirt on, lines of love in blue and pink, a symbol of solidarity with his son. He might not have imagined this in his infancy, but he wants all to see. He will face down the ignorant hate and say out loud, "The issue is not my child's existence, but your sunk cost persistence, the need to alienate, to hate. While you recline back into that petty mind, every day I find another way to feel a love that bursts my heart while you go thirsty." Thank you. I'm a huge horror movie fan, right? I love the classic kind of horror films. And I'm a huge fan of Peter Cushing, right? So I was doing the Stenning Festival about 4 months ago, and when I was there, I suddenly realised, oh my God, it's Peter Cushing's birthday today, and I had two poems I'd written about Peter Cushing that I'd never performed. So I thought, oh, I will perform them tonight, and because I love Peter Cushing. Again, I think for any outsider kids, one of those things about horror movies and Doctor Who and all of those kind of things is they had an otherness to them. So you would see eccentric and strange, you know, Tom Baker to me, now there was definitely a neurodivergent doctor, you know, there's a real, and Peter Cushing had this, like there's a lovely story that in his autobiography, he talks about if he was naughty when he was a little boy, his mum would punish him by pretending to be dead. Now, if there's any therapists in, you will know this has a lot of later life ramifications, right? And in the book, he actually says, if I was naughty, and I often was, my mother would sing a song and she'd say, "I'm going to go away, away. I'm going across the sea." And I'd say, "Oh, please don't die, Mummy. Please don't die. I promise to be good." And then I'd be naughty again and she'd be all dead in a chair. And my brother would come in and go, "Don't be so silly, Peter. You know she's not dead. Kick her. Shove her." But I couldn't because it was Mummy. And then one day I'd been particularly naughty, so she was being particularly dead. And I was very upset, and I had a piece of bread covered in jam, so I just shoved it in her face, and she never did it again. And... And so I wrote these, or performed these two poems for the first time. The first one is about Peter Cushing was such a professional that he smoked a lot, and he would always be worried that if he had a cigarette in a break, when he came back, his fingers might be more yellow than before, and people would go, "Dear Hammer Studios, I was very disappointed in Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed. I was thoroughly enjoying it, but in one scene with Freddie Jones, I noticed that at one point Peter Cushing's forefinger was very pale, and in the second one it looked a bit yellow. It ruined the film for me," right? So He would always wear little smoking gloves to have a cigarette. So this is just about Peter Cushing. Mark Gatiss, by the way, owns a pair. Oh, I envy that. Shout of cut, gloves straight on. Peter's of that generation gone where Betty promised perfect performance from a Chesterfield, while Joan would yield to a Camel, making the important actors note that they were the kindest to your throat. Peter smoked in every break, his voice still gentle in every take, whether menacing or kind. No trace of a rasp. His greatest fear that where he grasped his tube of delight, new finger stains just might anger those too zealous of their continuity. But we were too engrossed in his uncanny to begrudge him a fag and a cup of tea. And the next one is about, this is Helen Cushing. Some of you might know about this. Helen Cushing died in 1971, long before Peter died, and Peter was utterly, utterly, utterly brokenhearted for the rest of his life, and he could not wait to die because he wanted to join her. And on the day that she died, he immediately started running up and down the stairs, trying to give himself a heart attack, because he wanted to join her. And so this is just a very short poem about Helen and Peter. At Helen's final breath, you pine for your own death. In despair, your solution, run up and down the stair until your heart can take no more, and you can go rushing up behind her. Wait, wait, let me open heaven's door. After you, Helen, always after you. And I read that, Stenning. And then a woman came up to me. Her name was Beanie. And she was one of those people, you know, sometimes you see someone and you just see their face and you go, you are kind. You know that thing, you just go, I know you're kind. And she had the kindest face. And she said, I just thought you'd like to know, I was a trainee nurse at Canterbury Hospital in 1971. And my first ever job was looking after Helen Cushing. And the likelihood of that, synchronicity, coincidence, whatever. And she said Peter would always come up with fresh strawberries that he'd brought from the garden for me. And when she told me, it reminded me of something else. Now, some of you will remember the actor Ian Charlson, who perhaps was most famous for being in Chariots of Fire, the big Oscar-winning film of 1981. Also an amazing stage actor. He was in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof with Lindsay Duncan, Guys and Dolls. He was probably the first famous person from the UK to die from AIDS-related illness. And his last ever job was playing Hamlet. And what happened was Daniel Day-Lewis was playing Hamlet at the National Theatre, but Daniel Day-Lewis's dad had just died. And every time Daniel Day-Lewis had a scene with the ghost, he would see his father. And it gave him such stage fright that he couldn't go on. Now, at this point, Ian Charlson was extremely ill, but Richard Eyre, the director, said, would you like to come and play Hamlet? And Ian Charlson would have known this would be his last time on stage. His face was extremely swollen. They said that he had a sinus operation, and that's why it was swollen. No one knew publicly about his illness. And he went on stage every night and created something that was so... My friend Katrina saw it and said, I just couldn't stop crying. No one knew he was dying, but every time he spoke those soliloquies, everyone in the audience's heart broke. And I told a little story about it. I'd been on tour and I wanted to talk about this. And every night I'd run out of time. And I had my final gig. I was in Manchester. And I looked at my watch and I went, oh, no, I've run out of time. And then the technician at the back, she shouted out, don't worry, Robin, we've worked with you before. We factored in another 15 minutes, right? So I told the story about Ian Charlson for the first time and I walked off stage and a woman came up to me and said, it was lovely to hear about Ian. I was his hospice nurse for the last 3 weeks of his life. And this connection of stories that is in every single room. And then I found out more as well. In fact, there's about to be a film about this coming out called Elsinore with Andrew Scott as Ian Charlson and Olivia Colman as the wonderful actor Sylvia Sims, who some of you will remember from Ice Cold in Alex and also Victim, the great Dirk Bogarde film, which helped change laws. And I found out that Sylvia Sims, a lot of people were very offish with Ian Charlson. No one would wash his shirt because, as some of you will be old enough to remember, the attitude towards HIV and AIDS. And Sylvia Sims found it was hard for him to get in as well and get a lift in So she drove him in every single day, and she drove him home every single night, and she made food for him, and she continued to make food for him after the production. And you know, again, you look at certain people. When I ever saw Sylvia Sims, I would think, she looks like she's brilliant. And then you read the story and you go, she was brilliant. And so this is just a little poem thinking of them, and it's just called Sylvia and Ian. There's a secret in your face, swollen cheeks misplaced, eyes concealed by shades. They say, oh, a sinus operation. But really, you're a patient in your final days. How the newspapers would feed on your decay, call it a death deserved, tragic, but brought on by your perversion. The opportunity to play the Dane came because your predecessor saw a ghost. And now, each night, you confront your own. The audience don't know why this death speech speaks to them with such connection and emotion. Some who know your diagnosis insist on distance. They will not wash your shirts. But Sylvia, Sylvia, so plucky in that war movie of the 1950s, who starred with Dirk in the story that opened doors to change and to acceptance, reveals this character was more than just pretend, dismisses the propaganda of plague revulsion. Each night, she drives you home. The harshness of the world, the coldness expelled by kindness in the driving seat. I'm going to be honest, Jacko, I didn't think that was the best bit of accompaniment you've done on our tour so far. I mean, I liked it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, though. That's
Yeah, they noticed it.
Because I thought I'd got away with it. Sadly.
Yeah, yeah. It was a close-run thing. This is... Oh, man, I haven't got it. I was going to do... I wonder if I can remember it off by heart. I can't. I'm going to do a happy one now. I'll see if I've got that. One of my favourite ones that I sometimes do is... have I put it? Yeah, right. I have got it. This was... I have become everything I ever dreamed of, right? I quite often sit in my local graveyard and write poetry. And I think, oh, yeah, it's all happened for me now, right? And I love it. And I was sat in the graveyard, and I then had this sudden thought. It was just at dusk, and I heard in my head, first I was a grave, I was petrified. And I was like, oh, no! I'm going to have to write that then. So, this is a disco anthem for an abandoned tomb. First I was a grave, I was petrified, had no clue who was buried by my side. And I spent so many nights doing nothing much at all. Bit like a wall that's a victim of landfall. You've not returned. There is no place to bring me sunflowers now and put them in a vase. I should have avoided getting old, avoided getting cold, but I've grown moss. And without consciousness, I really don't give a toss. I can't go. Climb out the earth. My last expedition was being brought here in a hearse. The mourners showed their love with just a single tear. And then I crumbled because I'd been laid out. I died. Anyway, so that's how that Should we do the jam poem?
Which one?
Jam poem.
Jam.
This is when I was at Glastonbury last year. One of the things that I love at Glastonbury is not going to the main stage. I love just moving around and listening to people and kind of, you know, and eavesdropping. And I was walking to the first gig I had on Friday morning, and there was a woman in a hedge who sounded slightly kind of discombobulated. And she just said, do you think a cream tea will help null the effects of the acid? So, I thought, if that doesn't deserve a poem... So I wrote a poem. It's called Jam First or Acid First. That's obviously in Cornwall. In Devon, it's called Acid First or Jam First. And this is... So I love doing this one because Jacko creates this great kind of... Let's go for it, Jacko.
All right.
Well, that's the second mistake.
Yeah, yeah. Now, that one, I reckon you'd have got away with that one. I told you to bring the banjo.
Yeah. I'm not sure what happened there. But well,
But let's just smooth over it. Let's pretend.
There'll be a bloopers reel at the end of this, by the way, like at the end of Cannonball Run. He is Dom DeLuise for the day. Do you think cream tea will help null the effects of the acid? She asked in an uncertain reality or a possible dream. You see, here Woodstock meets the West Country. Lurpak meets Timothy Leary. Clotted Cream meets Ken Casey. Do you think a fruity scone will get the bad thoughts gone? Do you think a pot of Darjeeling will stop the screaming? Or is PG better with LSD? Stop drinking that, Scrumpy. Oh, at least until you stop chatting up that tree, because that daisy you proposed to earlier, it's getting pangs of jealousy. Tell you what. Manage your mind with a pink French fancy, because there's no bad trip with Mr. Kip. Ling, 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 ling.
There's normally crew. I normally have crew.
It's so funny because there's two things. Like when Jack was in King Crimson, they do 4 months of rehearsal, and he has a man that comes on and does all his plugging in. And with me, he'll send me a text going, "Are we going to rehearse before the gig or wing it?" And he goes, "And I know the answer." Something will happen if we just wing it, because I think it's really important. If you don't know what you're doing, you can't do it wrong, right? if we
hang on.
Yeah. But no, I mean that in a good way.
That's implying I don't know what I'm doing.
No, but I mean that of both of us, right? I like that thing. Like yesterday, I met an accordionist half an hour before I went on. And I went, "Do you want to come on with me?" And he came, and it was like, and I said, the thing to know is, with no rehearsal, it means there's no right version. So whatever happens, you know, I think so much of our world is filled with, you've got to get it exactly right. And then that immediately makes us feel bad when we've done things that aren't quite right. And I think it's so much more exciting. Errors are where the beauty lies, you know? I'm going to do only one more sad one, which is I'm going to do the Kenneth Williams one, if that's all right, Jacko.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan. I still am a big fan. I'm not a big fan of the Carry On films, apart from Carry On Screaming, Fenella Fielding. But I do. And also, of course, she was in Dougal and the Blue Cat as well. I loved Kenneth Williams' diaries. I read them a lot. I read a lot about him. I remember when I was reading the diaries once, I thought, I wonder what happened on the day I was born, the 20th of February, 1969. And I looked it up, and the diary entry is just, went to Croydon, very disappointing, came home early. So that was the end of that. And he was, you know, such an interesting man. And it's like Charles Hawtrey as well. You know, is anyone here from Deal in Kent or near Deal? Because, yeah, Deal, pubs like The Ship down Middle Street and stuff. And you used to, if you went to that pub, there were still landlords and landladies that you would overhear going, "And then Charles Hawtrey came in with three sailors. And I said, 'No, Mr. Hawtrey, no.' And he left with his tail between his legs." So... But I do feel, you know, that sadness of, like, recently, some of you may well know, down in, I've totally forgotten the name now of it. It's gone from my head. The fantastic LGBT bookshop right in Bloomsbury. Gay's the Word. Yeah, sorry. Gay's the Word moved about six doors down for a few months. So it was directly opposite the blue plaque, which remembers where Kenneth Williams was brought up. And I thought, what a world it would have been for young Kenneth if he'd looked opposite and he'd seen a bookshop that told him it was all right. And so I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about that last diary entry. And so this is just a little poem called Kenny. April 14th, 1988. Summary of your day. Back pain, still a bane. Rats gnawing the belly. Biscuits slow the pain. It's rubbish on the telly. And then as the tube is cooling, the ink runs from the fountain pen to the page. Oh, what's the bloody point? Too tired. Painted in a corner. As you lived, you hid, though often loudly, a camouflage of vocal excess, though in sober dress. Neat, dark suit. Buttoned up. Disgusted with your lust. Oh, starved of love. Holidaying with Kenneth and Joe on the beaches of Morocco where anything could go, but you stayed in the slow lane. Joe said, shed your inhibitions, but the closest submission to satisfaction, pillion on a moped, arms clasped around a waist, already inappropriately close. Although you could take whatever you please, you'd only take a Barclays. And then Joe would have a go at prizing the oyster open, see what you'd impart of your rendezvous. But the shame that came with coming meant hating your true desires and those dreams of soldiers. No navy lark for you, like Hawtrey by the sea. Outrageousness, your replacement for the eternal deferment of gratification. No lovely eeks or lovely ryers to stoke your fires. An accidental overdose. That was the verdict. A life of never enough, then extinguished by too much.
Thank you.
Here's one I've not done for ages. This is, if anyone here's from Derby or knows the beautiful Dormouse bookshop in Belper, just a few stops out. Yeah, brilliant. Well, fantastic bookshop and very near Scarthin Books as well, which is, Scarthin Books, what a beautiful, it's just got everything there. Homerty Pie and a wide selection of fiction and non-fiction. Who could ask for anything more? And, but yeah, I was in the Belper bookshop in Dormouse Books and most of her fiction is by women, which is, you know, not particularly surprised. There's an enormous number of female authors, you know. And she says, because of that, about once a month, a man, a different man, but always a man in what she describes as very deliberate red trousers. And I think you know what she... will come in, stand in the middle of the shop and then go, I see you don't have any books for white middle-aged men. And then charge out, right? And... So this is a little poem called Hashtag Not All Red Trousers. His red trousers clothe him in a cliché he is keen to confirm. His face matches in the umbrage. He wants to lecture but not to learn. He charges, grumbles, brays. Without turning a page, he upbraids the bookseller. No books for middle-aged white men like me, I see. Entirely ignoring the John Le Carré. Too progressive, probably. But what of all those Atwoods, Austins, Aeneas Nins, Oakleys, O'Briens and O'Connors? Well, they're probably all lesbians. Armfield, Adebayo and Alderman, Carter, Reese and Spark. Will their courageous pens castrate the notion of your manliness, taint you with a femininity you can't remove, however hard you rub? His statement made, the shelves untouched. He leaves, untainted, unacquainted with any words that may emasculate. So he can march on and say, aren't men just great? In a house just down the road, his wife is reading Wharton, remembering dismal intercourse and pondering divorce. So...
thank you.
I will. I was told that you'd like to ask questions, so I'll do a few. We're going to do a few more poems, and then I just want to do this one. I don't know if you want to join it. This is the one about Renee Good. And if you want to... So when Renee Good was murdered by ICE this year, one of the things that kind of horrified me was the speed in which many of the media joined in dehumanising her, you know, because of her sexuality, because she had pronouns in her... because she said that she was a poet. And we've also seen. I change it every. There's not an order, in case you've guessed. It always seems amazing to me that I wasn't. I know. Yeah, I just love the look of surprise when I say a poem and you go, oh, I don't even know that one. I'll just come. It doesn't bloody happen with Robert Fripp, I can tell you. But I wanted to see. I'm just going to see if there's a. I might have it somewhere. But I'm going to start off with this poem because I think it is. I'm so sorry for mucking around. This is. Oh, not there. It is. Right. Somebody here. This is one of my favourite things, by the way, just while I forgot I kept it in there. I collect knitting patterns. I really love it. I don't knit. And my favourite knitting patterns are one of a man and a woman in cable net, right? There's quite a few of them, because the man's always looking out like that and the woman's looking over there, and I call that genre. He doesn't know it yet, but she's leaving him soon. Right, so, I haven't got that one. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. This is a quick light one. This is, I was at Morecambe Poetry Festival last year. I go to Morecambe Poetry Festival every year. No, you're just, you keep making up your tune and everything, right? And, Morecambe...
It wasn't me.
No, I know.
There was a...
What happened? I knew this would happen. He's been... The whole summer, I've seen him on a downward slide. Why do you have to turn everything into panto?
Oh, no, I don't.
Yeah! So this is when I was at Morecambe Poetry Festival last year. Right? Morecambe is a really... It's a town that is struggling, but like so many towns, it's filled with people with a great big load of fight and heart, and it's very friendly, right? So I got there. I get there about 3 in the afternoon. I start walking on the seafront, and it's so beautiful. This man just charges up to me and goes, "Hello!" And I had that horrible moment. You might have had it during this festival. You know when someone comes up to you and then you go, I can't remember who this is, but I'm going to just kind of keep talking. Eventually, I'm going to work out who it is. And I'm like, is he someone I've met in the audience? Is he another poet? I don't know. And he goes, oh, my God, you must be cold. I said, no, I'm not cold. He went, really? You're not cold in just a T-shirt? I said, no, I'm not. He went, really? I said, no, really? And then he felt my arm and he went, you're not, are you? Bye. So didn't have a clue who I was. He was worried about my skin. He was like, oh, well, it's warm enough. I've got to go and check on her now because she looks a bit chilly as well, right? And everywhere I went, there was just these beautiful kind of moments. A man comes up to me and he goes, I'm glad to see you're not in a jacket. We're the only two. Everyone else is in a jacket, aren't they? What are they going to do in January? Die of hypothermia, I imagine, right? So just all this going on. And so I'm enjoying all these little connections, and it gets to dusk and I'm walking past a bus stop and there's a man there with two big carrier bags and an overcoat, and he looks up at me and he goes, homo. And that's when the mood changed. So this is a little poem for the man who shouted homo. I'm walking on the promenade in my T-shirt for whatever happened to baby Jane. And someone waiting for the 755 has got something they think's worth saying. Homo. He shouts impulsively. Now, I'm impressed by his cultural knowledge of LGBT. I mean, he'd have exploded if I'd been wearing my T-shirt of an even younger Betty. Though his intonation smacked of disgust, I think he really must have meant a little compliment. I've been lifting weights of late, and I have a hairy chest and face. And what I think he actually meant with that ugly stare was to say, if I'm honest, Papa, you're a bear. I have since been told I may be between a bear and a twink. It is, I think, something called an otter, which I'm told is even hotter. So that's... Right, I found it. So these are two that I'll end on. Like I said, I'll do questions in a minute. But in fact, I'm going to do this. Right, this is a serious poem, and this is... I just wrote these on Friday. I was at the vigil for Jason Arday. I don't know if any of you were there at Trafalgar Square. And it was the most heartbreaking, beautiful and sad. The whole of Trafalgar Square was full. And there was such silence during the speeches. And all the time, there was this... And when we went to all go and lay flowers at the base of Nelson's Column, the movement was slow and there was an incredible level of respect... of camaraderie, but also of questions. what do we need to do to stop a world where every single supposed side of our press, and as we know, it's a very thin slither that they actually represent. And I have a few friends who knew Jason Ardern. My friend Kath, who was absolutely heartbroken, and she said, you know, she'd done various events with him, and she said he just brought so much into every room. He changed every room, and he changed the potential of people. So whatever, what it turns out, these minor infractions, because it was never the major one that all the press went with, all those 300 articles, if they'd actually found out a bit about the human being, they would have found out here was someone who improved the world by existing within it. And I hope we can change. Just stop buying the press. Stop being part of the media, because people say, will the media learn? They're not going to learn anything, because this is what the media are. It's not for them to change, because they're doing what they do. It's for us to find a way of making new platforms for new voices. And so I've never read this out before, and this is just about the vigil. In the vigil, a stillness, a silence, inaudible to your accusers who gossiped you to the coffin. It's a love unimaginable to those who are shameless and will always be blameless, that cannot conceive of the guilt that we feel from our failure to lift up our voices, make shields to surround you and show you were needed. I'd rather you'd become a great grandfather than a martyr. So let us try to learn to teach ourselves and our children what we'd rather have heard from your mouth and your heart.
Thanks, Jacko.
Thank you, and I promise, you know, if you ever, there's still so much negativity, there's still people justifying what they did, and as I said, every single person, some of the speeches were, if you can go online, actually, there were a lot of the speeches were filmed, but if you've not seen them already, please watch them, because, you know, Dawn Butler, and oh man, anyway, right, so this is for Rene Good. This is about all of those people, all of the self-proclaimed poets, all of the people who lift up their voices, all of those people. You know, I always think nearly all the people that I really admire and loved were marginalised in their lifetime. Like, I'm wearing a t-shirt today of Sinead O'Connor, who was a true hero to me from the moment I first saw her, and it has a quote that she used to often say, which is beautiful, which was, they buried me but they didn't know I was a seed, right? And so this is for Rene Good and for everyone here, who all of, you know, every those moments when we're filled with doubt but we still raise our voice. If you are a self-proclaimed poet, it's important that you know that the USA is not always the place to be. If writing verse, you hope might be free. You'll be eyed suspiciously. They may sneer at your creativity. Does it make proper money, like the arms industry? But no, those voices who only see the money deal, well, they'll never find a way to feel the rebellion and the revolution, the invigoration and the beauty of Audre Lorde and Walt Whitman, of Andrea Gibson, of Nikki Giovanni, of Sylvia Plath. They heard those hollow hearts around them. They knew the damage they would do with their deadly, deadly, dull, dull beats that imitate a life. Instead, they chose unfettered imagination, emancipatory creation, rejection of presumptions where the limit of your life is not the colour of your skin or the clothes that you were put in. They threaten the system of control and they say no, no to your expectations. They see through your pathetic frame, your manly girdle and those blue pills which aim to inflate that ersatz genitalia. And in the anger of their impotence, they'll burn the library down, not knowing that the ashes will fertilise the soil. And they'll shout at the beauty, not knowing that it will help it to grow. And they'll be infuriated by the rainbows, and they'll cut their fingers as they tear at the roots of what blossoms, and those bloodless hands will shrivel. and they'll scream at the unfairness of justice finally being served. And all because the self-proclaimed poet dared to proclaim, dared to tell us, take your mind and take your pen and poison the monsters with a love that will choke them.
Woke?
What?
Woke. Is that the rock
one? Yeah, it's a rock one you did. This is, I'm 57, I'm woke. I imagine many of you are woke as well. It's good being woke, because I've met some people that are anti-woke, and if you're anti-woke, all you talk about is the woke. Whereas, if you're woke, you talk about crustaceans, the shape of a cloud, an interesting pylon you saw. It's brilliant. You have a really, really good time. So, no one talks about pronouns more than Lawrence Fox. I mean, so anyway, this is called Woke. Are you ready to rock this one out, Jacko?
Well, let's not get carried away.
Well, no, let's get carried away. I'm full of rage. I'm full of love. I'm exposed. The rage grows from the love. The love sweetens the rage, gives it reason, gives it purpose, gives it energy. A rage for creation, a rage for inclusion, a rage to catch others if they start falling. I want a world that evolves, that exposes hate for what it is, a carapace. The power to manipulate, to take. I offer rage and I offer love. I will not be warped, it will not distort me, it will power me. I rage for community, I rage for beauty, I rage for unity of ambition that says, you are included, we are here. This is fragile, aren't we all? Don't squander all that delicacy of thought on hate. Transform those flags of anger into shawls for the cold. Take the stones you were going to throw and make them into rocks that we can build with. Thank you, Jacko. I think you did let yourself go. I did feel you let yourself go. Just a couple more and then I'll take the this one is my friend Joe, who's a wonderful tap dancer, and the first time that I met Joe, I saw her late night at Edinburgh Fringe about 21 years ago, and this is a great example of those neurodivergent moments, right? So I saw a tap dance and I was like, oh my god, that's the best thing I've seen on the Fringe, it's amazing. And I had to bound up to her, right, because I get very excited when I see things that I love, and so, and I said, oh my god, that tap dance is the best thing I've seen on the Fringe, it was absolutely amazing. You're Joe, aren't you? She went, yeah, I am. I said, look Joe, I'm doing a show about 3 hours before you, so I'm so sorry, by the way, because I've realised that I've really picked up speed on this and I'm making it much harder for a signer that I've not met before, and I have been trying to slow down, so first of all I'd like to apologise to you, and I didn't meet you before, but thank you so much for doing this. It's thank you, round of applause. You won't believe it, but generally I've been doing it at half speed, so anyway, I saw Joe and I said, look, I've come up with this idea, and you might think the idea is a bit mad, but I just think it'll be fun, right? In the show that I do 3 hours before you, I read out from giant killer crab novels, such as Night of the Crabs, Crabs on the Rampage, Crab's Moon, Origin of the Crabs. I'm sure you're aware of the genre. But anyway, in Crabs on the Rampage, the moment where the giant crabs come ashore and they start eating all the beach donkeys and also any of the children that can't run fast enough. And I was just thinking, wouldn't it be amazing if while I'm reading out the crab carnage of the donkeys, you're tap dancing in exactly the same rhythm and speed as their pincers opening and closing. Would you like to join in? She went, that sounds bloody amazing, I'd love to, right? And that is, and we look back now and we realise that's not a neurotypical opening gambit. So what is the, can I just see what crab is, by the way, just out of, oh man, that's cool, thank you. So anyway, this is about when I met, like, my friend Josie Long, Grace Petrie, you might have seen this weekend. You know, the kind of those people that you meet and you just know you vibrate at the same speed. Before a word, a sudden whir. Then, light speed ignition. Unconscious recognition of something within. Two minds vibrating at the same speed. clattering and shattering the bland. Pupils dilate, thoughts pulsate, the need to create. A mating not of lust, oh no, nothing so unstable. This is a bonding of the must, the instantaneous weaving, conceiving, breathing out the wonderful, inhaling the elevating, words tumbling, fracturing the laws of physics, so different from the cynics. Not, what are you telling me that for? But tell me more, more, more. Oh, communication full of creation, the instantaneous sensation of a frantic friendship. After years of concealing, the mask drops. The critic stops. The fabulousness of fearlessness. The fearlessness of fabulousness. Oh, questions, innit? Yeah. Who would anyone like to ask a question? We've got a question over there. Brilliant. Any questions to the microphone? I'll tell you what, find people and I'll do another quick poem, and then every time you found... Oh, no, you found someone? Yep.
I'm going to come out and round.
Right, anyway, so I'll start this one. I'll stop when Hello. You get the mic there. Late Saturday night, we reject the high life, the clubs and the bars, for warm brie and Broadway stars, elated around the kitchen table. Plenty of Sondheim, no Mac and Mabel. Little bit of some Shirley and some Judy too. Another oat cake. Oh, man. I've just realised this is unfair. Oh, what a pain. We forgot Singing in the Rain. Anyways, that's halfway through and we've got a question. Yeah,
we've got a question.
Hi there.
Hello.
I just wanted to ask, how do you respond when people attribute your creativity largely or solely to being neurodiverse?
Well, I just accept that that's what so many of us are. It's like, because I don't see it as a separate thing. It's like if someone says to me, would you like not to be ADHD? Well, I don't know what that is, because that's literally saying, would you like to be someone else? And so I think it's a really, you know, again, this is why quite often when we see with things like autism, et cetera, and we see disorder attached, it makes it another thing that is attached to you, not what runs through you. So I realised that, you know, most of my friends and most of you know, and Grace would be a good example, you know, that the reason we create is part of who we are, and part of who we are is having a brain that goes off on all those directions and tangents, or in other ways has hyper-focus, as some people have on certain things. So I don't, you know, for me, whatever they want to say, they can say, but I'm just going to keep making stuff, you know, and whatever. And I don't think in any way it lessens it, because our mind is where we make, the magical and wonderful things that we can make. So I think I think there's a lot of problems in Western thinking. I think there's a huge problem with the fact we're very binary, we're very yes or no, and, you know, and again we see that with neurodivergence, we see that with sexuality and gender and all of those different things. We see that when we see, you know, someone to me like William Blake was a beautiful thinker, because he allowed you to have other realities which are your realities, which you don't have to prove to anyone else, but it's what you're experiencing. So I think, you know, there will always be loads of naysayers, and there'll always, you know, I've had, you know, the amount of kind of horrible things that I've had kind of, you know, sent to me, and threats and death threats and all that kind of thing. But I am in a position where I have never felt it is more just delightful, and I've never felt more empowered to connect with as many people as possible. And whatever people want to say, this is why you do it. Well, it doesn't matter. I do it. So I hope that's an answer. Over there, hello.
Hello. I'm going to try and get through this without crying. Okay. I don't want to ask a man about his age. I know that's rude. But I'm 52 as well, and I've just been diagnosed 2 weeks ago. And I want... It's not... If anyone else tells me it's a superpower, violence might happen. But how long does it take to get from this to that? Because at the moment, that critic is not shutting up, yes.
No, the critic can take... it still comes back occasionally for me. I mean, I think I was very fortunate that I didn't... I wasn't officially diagnosed initially. It was an autistic stranger who came and told me. And that, I think, made it in some ways easier, that it was someone who knew me, and I didn't know him. There were strangers, but he knew my work. I think it can... There is no exact in any way. It can be so different, and it can depend on the world that you've lived in. It can depend on the people who have judged you. It can depend on the fact that, you know, one of the big problems is that we will look back and we will go, I could have had that and I could have done this, and these opportunities were there. I think the really important thing to know is that the future is a better place than the past, and it won't, you'll still find yourself at times thinking this could have been what it is. But what you're going to find is the people that you are walking with now, the people who are going to be your friends, you may well lose friends, for instance. And if you lose friends, you haven't lost friends. You've lost people who knew you and didn't really care about you. Because anyone who is a true friend, there are people I no longer hang around. You know, one of the reasons Infinite Monkey Cage doesn't exist is precisely for that reason. For me, anyway, they're continuing it without me. But that it was because I realised all of these things. This was not a true connection. So what I can tell you is it can take time, but every now and again, just remind yourself, the direction I'm going in is a direction with so much more love, positivity, and so much more of an understanding of why you are. It might not be I never liked superpower, but it is a different set of powers. And you being able to see that your different set of powers, which will very often have been judged by people as being something that was negative, and they won't have seen all of the positive, because we always do that. We look at the things that we can't do and we go, well, I'm just useless, useless, useless. And you look at what you can do and you go, well, anyone could do that. Well, know that, no, not anyone could do what you do. Not anyone can be who you are. And you are going to find a point where you just won't be able to help you go, I need to make this. And it might be so many different things that you want to make. And yeah, so just know that their good times are there. Thank you so much for asking that. It's a very difficult thing, you know.
Robin, I've got one last one over here.
Oh Jacka, do you want to...
Sorry.
I'll just quickly take a footnote for Jacka, yeah. No, go on, Jacka.
I was going to say, my question was, I couldn't help notice that rather handsome, glossy-looking hardback book on the chair.
Oh, it's Capitalism. You tell us we'll deal with that later on.
Last question's over here.
Yes, go on.
Thank you for your compassionate and life-giving wit. Which means a great deal this afternoon. My family does understand the liberation that can come with diagnosis, full respect to the previous questioner. But the two Ds are so willfully aggressive and belittling. It's the most bollocks name for any condition.
Yeah.
So I wonder, my question is, what better things might those four letters stand for? What would you suggest?
Oh, man! This is why they've never invited me on Countdown!
attractively defiant, hilariously diverse.
I wrote a poem. It's called Always Dynamic Head Delight.
Thank you.
So I think, you know, that bit of the dynamism. And again, this is one of the things that shows how wrong society is. How many of us have got told off for being overly excited by something? How many of us have been told off for, well, don't keep banging on just because you love that thing? And what an awful position when you go, no. If you're hanging around with people who keep going, oh, you're so excited by that, don't hang around with those people. You know, love is, it's one of the things. Our politics and our media is filled with hate, right? You know, it's no surprise that some of the leading names in anti-trans are now supporting some of the academics who are supporting the racist who created the situation for Jason Arde, right? And if you are fed on hate, like I watched Gabor Maté, who I'm sure many of you have watched Gabor Maté, a beautiful human voice, and he tells the story of a friend of his who was a therapist whose nearly all of her family died in Auschwitz. And she survived. And one day she went to where the bunker was, Hitler's bunker, to not exactly forgive him, because she said, I'm not forgiving him for what he did, but I wish him to leave my heart because I wish to be full of love. And I think this is, again, what we have and what you will find so much, which is that bit of if we constantly, you know, people, we're taught from a very early age, when you go to school, you talk about something you love and people go, brilliant, they've mentioned something they love, we can smash it. Well, love is fragile and love is so much... It's like the orchid and the dandelion idea, right? Let us all be orchids. Not that dandelions aren't brilliant as well, by the way. I don't want to suddenly get into kind of a dandelion-orchid debate. I might as well have done the whole crochet knitting thing again. But... So, yeah, I think it's so important. And finding love... I mean, sometimes you find love in unusual places, such as this book by Jacko Ojaczyk. It is... This is not far more than a book just about prog rock. If you're interested in Jacko as a creator, you will love it. But also, it's about adoption and it's about identity. And very often when we drive to gigs, we will get talking about the fact that what Jacko has learnt about himself. And Jacko is, even though he looks younger than me, is actually very, very much older than me. And even though he has lovely hair as well, right? I'm just going to tell this story because I'll do it fast, okay. Right? Who's the boy with the lovely hair? It's not him just gloating at bald men like me, right? It's about the fact that the mother who adopted him, she had dementia. And Jacko went to visit her one day and said, how was the trip to London? And she went, oh, Jacko, we didn't go to London. And then he went, the guy who ran the home took him aside later on and said, Jacko, just so you know, we went to London, but your mum doesn't really have the memory for things like this anymore. And as he was talking, his mum came into the room and the nurse is there going, oh, no, come on, we're in the other room, aren't we? And she saw Jacko and she said, who's the boy with the lovely hair? And this book is such a beautiful book because it has so much love. And the fact that many of us are still, we're still finding out who we are. Many of us ignore, we feel it's embarrassing to mention trauma because we feel it's not traumatic enough. Your trauma is your trauma. There is not a league of trauma that says you are allowed to go on the ride and you are not. And this, I think, is a very important thing that I'll end on because I know that I've run out of time and I know that Charlotte Church is a very angry person. One of my favourite times of seeing Charlotte, again, someone with such a huge heart, was she was quite drunk and she was. It's a beautiful festival in Larne on the coast of Wales, and there was a band playing, and people just came up and guessed it, like John Cooper Clarke did, Blitzkrieg Bop and stuff. And then Charlotte came in, and the band went, "Come on, Charlotte!" And she kind of went up and said to them, "What do you want to do, Charlotte?" And she went, "I'll do Summertime." And then through that intoxication, as I've seen so many times, she then sang the most beautiful version of Summertime, and everyone went crazy. And they said, "Charlotte, do you want to do another song?" And she went, "Oh, yes, please." And they said, "What do you want to do?" And she went, "Summertime." So. But again, you're going to have such a great time. But this book, when we are able to start, like that James Baldwin thing, the reason we hold on to our hate is because if we let go of our hate, then we have to deal with our pain. But when we deal with our pain, one of the things is we become so much better allies and we're able to recognise other people's trauma and we're able to put our arms around them without any sense of shame and we're able to say, come on, let us all move together. And I hope you feel that today and I know you're going to sit with so many beautiful acts. So thank you very much to Jacko and thank you very much to you.
What a beautiful place to end. Thank you so, so much, Robin and Jacko.
Thanks very much, everyone.
Both of them are going to be signing over in
You Steven. Are lovely people.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.